Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning. I'm Wilmer Leon, sitting in for Roland Martin. Just ahead on News One Now, Freddie Gray trial shakeup. There may be a new team of prosecutors just as the case is expected to begin and the officers accused requested a judge decides their fate. We'll discuss the latest developments with Baltimore attorney Billy Murphy. A former prisoner takes legal action against New York City. The woman, Candy Haley, says she's abused by guards while in solitary confinement at Rikers Island. New controversy at the Citadel. Prestigious military college may be in hot water after denying a prospective student the right to wear a hijab. I'll break it all down with the student's spokesperson. It's time to talk about the God Box. Rapper and activist David Banner joins us to break down why his new album, The God Box, is the best hip-hop album to come out in a long time. A new study claims black students are leaving college with a disproportionate amount of debt compared to their white peers. News One Now starts right now. New developments in the Freddie Gray trials in Baltimore City. This morning, we've learned that a new team of prosecutors have reportedly been tapped to try the cases of two officers charged in the arrest and Freddie Gray's death. The Baltimore Sun is reporting that a memo was sent to prosecutors notifying them that Lisa Phelps, a veteran assistant state's attorney, and Sarah David, who joined the office in 2014, were selected to be part of what is called a clean team. Two officers charged in the case, William Porter and Garrett Miller, have been ordered to testify under immunity against their fellow officers. Prosecutors will have to prove that they did not allow any of those officers' testimony to influence the cases they presented against them. One of six Baltimore police officers charged in Gray's death has elected to have a bench trial instead of a jury trial. Edward Nero looks to have his case presented and decided by Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams in Baltimore tomorrow. As one of the arresting officers in the Freddie Gray trials, Nero was indicted on misdemeanor charges of second-degree assault, reckless endangerment, and two counts of misconduct in office. Joining us to discuss these matters is Freddie Gray's family attorney, William Billy Murphy. Also joining me on the panel today, Shermichael Singleton, Republican political strategist, Amber Phillips, co-director of Black, and Faraji Muhammad, host of Listen Up and co-host of the Larry Young Morning Show. Good morning, Mr. Murphy, how are you?
Good morning, how are you?
I'm doing fine, sir. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Tell us first, what's with the last minute prosecution team changeup?
Well, that's because when Porter testifies, if in fact he testifies, and I don't know whether this is the case for Porter's testimony or not. It has to be ascertained that nobody has been exposed to anything which would violate the Fifth Amendment so that this trial can proceed without being tainted by anything that was said before.
And what do you think, is there really the likelihood that a Fifth Amendment violation has occurred?
Well, no, it's not to keep it from, it's not that it has occurred, it's to keep it from occurring.
Keep it from occurring. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
it's you. Very difficult because it's almost impossible to prove that Porter's testimony has been untainted by a Fifth Amendment violation. It's a very complex legal analysis.
Why did former Officer Nero decide to request a bench trial instead of a trial by a jury of his peers?
Well, it's because he fears having a jury decide this case compared to having a judge. And what people missed the last time was that, according to a juror who finally talked about the deliberations, Officer Porter was two jurors away from being convicted unanimously of misconduct in office. It was reportedly a 10-2 split in favor of conviction. And misconduct in office carries a life sentence as a possible maximum sentence. So the emphasis in the coverage in the last trial was that he had been almost acquitted of the most serious charge. But that's like choosing the devil that you know and the devil that you don't. The most serious possible penalty was the misconduct charge.
Does the prosecution present the case in a different manner towards the judge as opposed to presenting the case before a jury?
Yes, it's a radically different approach. It's a more dry approach, devoid of emotion, because most bench trials are conducted with as little emotion as possible, because judges aren't going to be persuaded one way or the other by that. And they might, in fact, get turned off if you argue to them the same way that you argue to a jury. And a bench trial, of course, avoids what happened the last time. A judge can't be a hung jury. The judge can't not reach a decision in the case. If he thinks that the evidence is sufficient for proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and he's persuaded by the credibility of the witnesses, he will convict. Likewise, if he has a reasonable doubt, he will acquit. But there's no in-between failure to agree or anything like what happened the last time.
Amber, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm wondering this whole concept of him getting to choose what kind of trial he has. Have we seen this happen before in cases where we know that when people of color, particularly black people, go through the criminal justice system, it feels like we have so few options. Is this an option that everyone has to choose how their cases are heard and what process they're allowed to go through during their cases?
Back in the day when they were all white juries, Maryland has for years and years and years always permitted the unilateral waiver of the right to jury trial. So in most other states and in the federal courts, both sides have to agree to waive a jury. And if either side doesn't want to waive a jury trial, it will be. But Maryland permits the defendant to waive without having the consent of the prosecutor. So when there were biased juries, that was the preferred method of proceeding. But in the day of unbiased jurors, it's a rare proceeding. Mm-hmm. And it usually works against the defendant. Mm.
There was a pretrial hearing yesterday. Do you know some of the results or what transpired during that hearing?
No, because the hearing was not widely publicized. So we have to guess what that was about, but it may have been some pretrial motions of some sort that would be normal under these circumstances.
Sure, Michael, you have a question?
Yeah, I do, Attorney Murphy. I would like to ask you, I know for some reason this was a strategic move on the defense. With your experience as an attorney, what is the likelihood that the judge will find him not guilty?
Well, it's impossible to predict, but usually judges convict much more often than juries. We used to joke in the criminal practice that taking a bench trial is like taking an extended guilty plea.
So this may actually benefit the family. We may actually get some type of a guilty out of this based on historical precedent.
Well, he better have a doggone good reason to believe that Judge Williams is going to acquit him. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, you've narrowed the odds. There are many arguments which appeal to jurors that don't appeal to judges. So it's a rare move.
I'm also wondering, too, that I would like to believe that this is a completely fair trial, but I wonder if it makes a difference that the police officer, he's also a police officer and he's a part of the criminal justice system as well.
No, Judge Williams' background is as a Justice Department police prosecutor. Mm-hmm. He spent his career before coming on the bench prosecuting crooked cops.
Attorney Billy Murphy, thank you so much. We'll keep in contact with you as this whole thing unfolds. Thank you again very much. Billy
You're
Murphy from
welcome.
Baltimore.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now to the latest in the race to the White House. West Virginia held primaries for both Democrats and Republicans yesterday, while Nebraska voters headed to the polls for the Republicans. Here are the results. Senator Bernie Sanders won West Virginia. Now he has a total of 1,464 delegates. Former Secretary Hillary Clinton has 2,235 delegates. 2,383 delegates are needed to secure the Democratic nomination. Despite the loss, Clinton is still on track to win the Democratic nomination, but Senator Sanders is pushing for a contested Democratic convention this summer in Philadelphia. He is appealing to Clinton's superdelegates, hoping they will switch their support to him. Meanwhile, on the GOP side, Donald Trump swept the primaries in West Virginia and Nebraska. Senator Ted Cruz and Governor John Kasich dropped out last week, but Senator Cruz now says he could re-enter the race if he sees a path to victory. Trump is now calling for the GOP to unite behind him and gear up to take on Clinton in November. As the party tries to unite, many are now wondering what a Trump presidency would really look like. His controversial comments have offended just about every minority group. London's newly elected mayor, Sadiq Khan, blasted Trump for suggesting America should ban all Muslims.
I think Donald Trump has ignorant views about Islam. It's not just about me. I don't want to be the exception to be allowed to go to America. My concern is he's playing into the hands of extremists who say it's not compatible to be Western and to be mainstream Muslim. I think London showed last Thursday it is. Donald Trump may well be the Republican candidate. You won't be surprised that I'll be backing the Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, who I suspect will be, and I hope that she trounces him.
Trump's scrutiny as a global leader comes as President Obama prepares for his historic trip to Hiroshima, Japan. The president's visit will mark the first time a sitting American president has visited the site where the United States dropped an atomic bomb. The White House has ruled out the possibility that the president will apologize for the bombing. Let's hear from the panel on this. First of all, what do you see as being the impact of Donald Trump's rhetoric in terms of the global stage? What do you, if he were elected president, could he be truly the leader of the free world?
The rhetoric of Donald Trump, we've had this rhetoric throughout our election process, right? We've been talking about Black Lives Matter for a few years now. We've been talking about our lives being lost on the street. Donald Trump is actually a product of the rhetoric and our refusal to really talk about racism in this country. So I think it's going to continue to look like us moving in that same direction. I'm really worried about the moment that we're in with activists who are really protesting and speaking up for their rights and how it's literally causing these explosions and collisions at his rallies, let alone what could potentially happen on election day.
But as a presidential candidate who has offended Mexico and Mexicans, as a presidential candidate who says that Muslims should be banned and not allowed to enter the country, you now have the newly elected mayor of London saying, as a Muslim, he would, in a Trump administration, he would not be allowed in the United States. You have people in London that passed petitions banning Donald Trump from England if he is elected, as well as Germany. Again, how does this impact the global stage?
So to answer the question more directly, I think as you look at trade, as you look at unilateral relationships globally, it is very, very important that you're able to sustain relationships with various countries. I think right now, in particular, as you look at the Middle East, you look at our relationship with Israel, and a lot of the things that are going on in Syria, you definitely want someone who has the ability to articulate America's positions on what's going on in the Middle East, but also build new relationships so that we can hope to foster a new environment to sort of lower some of the violence that we're beginning to see in the region. I think as you look at traditional allies such as Great Britain, Germany, France, there have been a couple other countries that have been allies of the United States that have voiced their concern. For me personally, from a policy perspective, I'm wondering how that's going to affect our policy positions with those countries, particularly trade. And so it's my hope that once we enter into the general election that Mr. Trump will pivot from some of his statements, which may not help, but it's my hope.
Yeah, because you can't unring the bell.
You're correct.
So it's my hope that,
it is my hope that he will pivot and recognize how essential those relationships are for the advancement of the United States.
He should already know that.
Let me ask you this, Faraji. President Obama has has extended and improved relationships with Cuba.
Right.
He has, we have the Iran nuclear deal.
Right.
We now have the president going to Japan, and based upon the first sitting United States president to go there, that will only, I believe, improve relationships with Japan.
Right.
Very positive movements in that regard, but then you've got a Donald Trump in the background making such negative comments.
I think, you know, what we're seeing from Donald Trump is this personification of American exceptionalism and this ideology saying that, you know what, America is the greatest country on earth, that America does not need to be fixed, that there doesn't need to be an improvement. As a matter of fact, the rest of the world needs to shift its gears to be like America. That's dangerous, especially in this day and time. The reason Donald Trump decided not to ban Muslims from coming into the country, because he already understands that in other parts of the world, America is hated by the countries in Middle East, Syria and whatnot. And they know that if they were to open their doors, you don't know who you're going to be letting into the borders. And essentially, you might be setting yourself for other issues to come up within on domestic ground.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with American exceptionalism. However, I do think that you do have to realize and recognize that we do have some issues and problems that we have to address. And to attempt to ignore those things, I think, is foolish.
It's one thing to consider yourself to be exceptional. It's another thing to conduct your policy as though you are, because we wind up doing this at the expense of other nations. Just ahead on News One Now, a woman who spent over 2 years in solitary confinement at Rikers Island is now suing the city of New York for abuses. The Citadel tells a prospective student she can't wear a hijab. While we'll discuss that in a bit. Rapper and activist David Banner talks about his new God Box album and lecture series. We'll discuss how and why black students are getting saddled with student loan debt and what you need to do to avoid it. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at news1.com. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon, at News One Now, or on News One's Facebook page. It's 17:17 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
A Bronx woman, Candy Haley, who spent over 2 years in and out of solitary confinement in Rikers Island, is now suing the city of New York for $10 million. 32-year-old Candy Haley was accused of stabbing a baby during a 2012 incident. While awaiting trial, Haley was placed in solitary confinement after an alleged confrontation. During her time in confinement, she says she was subjected to sexual and physical abuse by the guards. As a result, she tried to commit suicide more than 100 times, once by swallowing a bottle of Nair, which is a hair removal chemical. She also has several scars on her forearms from trying to end her life. She used anything she could find, from pieces of plastic cups to broken light bulbs. Ms. Haley was hospitalized in psychiatric wards 8 times during her incarceration, but was continually put back into solitary confinement. A correction department spokesman says the claims were being investigated. She was acquitted of the charges in May of 2015. Joining us on Skype from New Jersey is Paul Presta, attorney for Ms. Candy Haley. Welcome. How are you?
Good morning, Roland. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And did I pronounce your name properly?
It's Prestia, but that's fine.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'll get it right. And still with us on our panel, Faraji Muhammad, Shermichael Singleton, and Amber Phillips. So where are we right now with this lawsuit?
Well, Roland, we recently filed a notice of claim with the city of New York indicating our intent to sue the city of New York, its agencies, and the individuals involved in Candy Haley's treatment.
Is this really a matter of her word versus the word of the guards? Or what type of evidence do you have to support her claims of abuse?
Well, we have almost the entire file already from the Department of Corrections. Yes, part of it is her word, but we do have the psychiatric records from Elmhurst Hospital indicating that she was taken from solitary confinement to a psychiatric ward at Elmhurst Hospital 8 times, where she had stints in the psychiatric ward and then brought back to Rikers Island. And there are numerous, voluminous medical records indicating that she was brought over and over and over just to the clinic for suicide attempts and incidences of use of force by corrections officers. And she did make a report that she was sexually assaulted by one corrections officer while she was held down by a probe team. And we have that officer's name, John Warren. So we expect to investigate that, and we'll be asking the Bronx District Attorney, Rikers Investigation Unit, to investigate that officer and bring charges against him.
Can you describe, without being too graphic, probe team?
But go ahead.
I'm saying, can you describe for us, without being too graphic, what is a probe team?
Probe team's really essentially a SWAT team that comes in once the officers have restrained an inmate for use of force. So just picture a SWAT team with helmets, shields, full, almost military uniform coming in to subdue an inmate. And this happens quite frequently in uses of force in Rikers Island. And, you know, after that incident, Roland, Ms. Haley was so traumatized by that sexual assault that she actually oftentimes covered herself in her own feces so that the officers wouldn't take that sort of action against her again.
There are an estimated 2.2 million people that are incarcerated in the United States, 80,000 to 100,000 people in solitary confinement. We hear these numbers fairly regularly, but no matter how many times you hear them, they never become less disturbing. Faraji, you have a question.
Mr. Prestia, question is, one is, what has the warden of this facility said about this whole incident? Was there any statement, any formal statement that's have come out from the warden yet?
No, not at the moment. I believe that basically the commissioner had given the standard answer that they're investigating these claims.
Really?
And that's all we're gonna hear from them, I believe.
Wow.
Probably throughout the case until if and when it's settled or it goes to trial.
Sure, Michael?
Yeah, I wanna ask, you know, can you describe to us, you know, how she's doing? Is this taking a toll on her, going through this process, trying to get justice for herself? I think oftentimes we focus on the legalities of these things, but sometimes we forget about the person. And I really wanna focus on how she's doing mentally, spiritually, physically.
Right. Well, clearly the damage is irreparable. We've tried to, you know, take care of her and make sure that she's in a safe place right now, because obviously her condition is, she's very unstable right now. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to get her in a safe, stable place so that she can heal herself and assimilate back into society. And it's a very slow process and a very, you know, we have to be very gentle and compassionate with her. Mm-hmm. As she goes forward. It's a day-to-day thing. So we're constantly checking up on her. You have to remember, and I spoke at a rally yesterday against sexual abuse of female inmates at Rikers Island. You have to remember, number one, she was never convicted of a crime. She was merely accused mm-hmm. and held in Rikers Island for 39 months. Also, as a female, you have to understand that her treatment was different than male inmates. For example, she menstruated in solitary confinement. And more than once, she was not provided sanitary napkins or pads to clean herself. And on one occasion, she menstruated and sat in her cell for 4 days with dried blood and used her jumpsuit to clean herself before a captain demanded that she be brought to the shower. 4 days in that cell. And then when she was brought to the shower, as she always was, she was shackled by the hands and feet and given a spit mask just to be brought to the shower. So tell me if that doesn't invoke some sort of image of slavery. Mm-hmm. This is the treatment she endured for 3 years in solitary confinement. Wow. 2 years is inaccurate.
Right. That's awful. And I'm so appreciative that you asked this question, because we're having countless examples of not only do we have these black women who are going through this process of being convicted and being held, but there's this other piece that, because we are women, we're also like sexually abused. The officer who was just convicted for sexually assaulting countless black women from various ages, it's absurd. And I'm glad that we're having this conversation, that we have folks like you really going to the defense to make sure that it's not just her advocating for herself, or it's not just black women advocating for ourselves, that this is a collective effort from all of us.
Attorney Paul Prestia, thank you. Just, go ahead, sir, quickly.
It ranges from the whole spectrum. You know, I represented Khalif Browder, and I represent his family, who you might recall was a teenager when he was sent to solitary confinement at Rikers Island. Mm-hmm. And it varies through the whole spectrum, teenagers to women, to adult women. And it's reprehensible and egregious.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Attorney Paul Prestia, attorney for Candy Haley. When we come back, the Citadel tells a prospective student no hijabs allowed. We'll discuss this next. Find out why rapper David Banner named his new album The Gold Box, and why he says God is closer than you may think. We'll break down the student debt numbers and explain why they're much worse for black students. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at newsone.com. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon, or at News One, or on News One's Facebook page. It's 28 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
New controversy at the Citadel. After more than a month of deliberations, the Citadel Military College announced its decision to deny a prospective student the right to wear a hijab with her uniform. The student, whose name has not been released, was accepted to the esteemed military college and planned to join the incoming freshman class. Upon her acceptance, she requested to wear a hijab, a scarf worn by women of the Muslim faith. School officials at the Citadel had been considering the request since April, ultimately denying it. Tuesday. Had the request been accepted, it would have been the first change to uniform policy in school history. According to reports, the student's family is weighing their legal options, but school officials aren't budging. Citadel President Lieutenant General John Rosa released a statement about the decision, saying, quote, "As the Military College of South Carolina, the Citadel has relied upon a highly effective educational model requiring all cadets to adopt a common uniform. Uniformity is the cornerstone of this four-year leader development model," end quote. Joining me now to discuss the issue is Ibrahim Hooper, a spokesperson for the student's family and national communications director for the Council on American Islamic Relations. Mr. Hooper, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And still with us on the panel, Faraji Muhammad, Shermichael Singleton, and Amber Phillips. Mr. Hooper, so what? I know the family is still going through or evaluating its options, but talk to us about what is your position on this issue?
Well, we believe it's a constitutional issue. We believe that everyone has the right to practice their faith at every level of society. Even our own nation's military accepts hijab, accepts Sikh beards and turbans, accepts Jewish yarmulkes. It shouldn't be a stretch for a corps of cadets, which, by the way, isn't a military organization, to accept these things. I mean, this whole argument of tradition is the same argument that was put forward to keep African Americans out of the Corps of Cadets until 1996. and to keep women out of the Corps until 1995. And even at that time, the first woman had to be escorted onto the campus by U.S. Marshals. Mm. So we view this as a continuation of the civil rights movement and an anachronism in our increasingly diverse society.
For the audience to understand, she's not asking to wear a burqa, to have her entire body covered. She's simply asking to wear a scarf over her hair. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And it's the same scarf that's worn in many militaries around the world, including our own. The Sikhs who wear turbans and beards have a hundreds of years long military tradition. And nobody said the Sikhs should take off their turbans even in battle. You have the Scots wearing kilts in battle and a long military tradition. So these kinds of arguments of, we just can't change it because it hasn't been changed. Well, that won't pass constitutional muster.
Amber?
I'm also wondering, so when folks come into places like the Citadel or West Point, what kind of additional training or access do they have to climb the ranks of the military? So when we have folks who wear hijabs are from different backgrounds, what benefit does the Citadel get from them being there, and what additional resources or benefit do they get from attending something as prestigious as the Citadel?
Well, anytime you have increased diversity in an organization like the Citadel, you're going to have the benefits of different perspectives, different ways of thinking, different approaches to problems. And we should remember, too, that the Citadel is a public institution. It's paid for by taxpayer dollars. It's not, and you're not in the military when you're in the Citadel. Often the response we get from people is, when you join the military, you give up rights. Well, when you join the Citadel, you're not in the military, actually.
So, Ms. Tooper, this is Sher Michael Singleton. I want to ask you, the Citadel, just like West Point, a lot of these military academies typically prepare students for a career in the United States Armed Forces. If our Armed Forces has a standard where this type of attire is acceptable, I would imagine that legally you guys would have a pretty clear-cut case. Could you give us a little more further details on if you guys are going to take legal action and if you're pretty confident that you will do well if you decide to do so?
Well, obviously, we're a civil rights organization defending the rights of American Muslims and others, by the way. Mm-hmm. So we can't really let this issue drop. We can't just accept the fact that a Muslim woman would be not denied entry to the Citadel basically for the rest of eternity, that you'll never have a Muslim woman practicing her faith at the Citadel. You'll never have a Sikh man practicing his faith at the Citadel, or a Jewish man practicing his faith at the Citadel. This just can't stand. So we will be obligated to challenge it in some form legally. What that form will take, we're still in discussions with the family. But by the way, South Carolina law, if you even put aside the Constitution, South Carolina law prohibits this kinds of discrimination. So
Thank
there
you,
are
Mr.
many
Hooper.
Approaches to take on this issue, and we're quite confident that will ultimately prevail and that the Constitution will prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Hooper, very much. Ibrahim Hooper from the Council, National Communications Director for the Council of American Islamic Relations. Coming up on News One Now, student loan debt is at an all-time high and is hitting black students the hardest. We'll discuss why and what can be done to solve it. Plus, find out which presidential candidate, rapper, and activist David Banner likes most. We'll be right back.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
It seems that earning a college degree is getting more expensive every day. This is a hardship for many. But the numbers are especially bad for black students. According to a study by the Brookings Institution, there are racial debt disparities in low to moderate income student families. Black students leave college with an average debt of $27,000, while white students incur an average of $20,000. Black students are also borrowing at a higher rate than their white counterparts. 81% of black students borrow money for higher education compared to 63% of white students. Student loan expert Heather Jarvis joins me now via FaceTime to explain these numbers and offer a few solutions. Heather, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am well. I am well, thank you. Give us some more detail, but what's really going on behind these numbers?
Well, we've seen the cost of higher education go up so fast, and incomes have failed to keep pace with the rising cost of tuition. And at the same time, we have policies around financial aid that have really shifted us to a debt-based system of access. So instead of having grant funding that's sufficient to meet the needs of black and low-income families, we have placed the burden squarely on students and their families to borrow the money needed to pay for these higher costs.
Policies that lead to debt-phased positions. Talk about specifically what types of policies are you talking about?
Well, for example, states have reduced their investment in higher education. And so the Pell Grant, one of the premier financial aid systems, goes far less completely towards the cost of education than it once did. So we have really quite purposely created a system where everyone can access college, but only if you're willing to take on debt. And that has a disproportionate impact on low-income families.
What are some of the steps that people can use to avoid incurring such debt?
Well, it's helpful to think about this process early and do what you can to build wealth. Of course, that's easier said than done. And some of the things like tax deferred savings are more effective for families who already have some wealth. But it's helpful to consider the cost of education when evaluating educational opportunities, as well as to pursue as much free aid like grants and scholarships as possible early in the process by doing things like filling out that free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA.
Pam?
Ms. Jarvis, good morning. Faraji Muhammad. Quick question. We know that 43 million Americans are saddled with student debt, and that is in the amount of $1.3 trillion. The president has come out with his plan, Pay As You Earn program, which helps to cap the amount that a person can would they need to pay up to 10% of their monthly income. Do you feel like the government, the president, is doing enough to remove some of the burden from black students, or should there be a greater push to make college free, especially community colleges and some other four-year institutions?
The government's policies and the president's initiatives have gone a long way towards reducing the burden of student debt. So the Pay As You Earn program is excellent and important, but it's really a band-aid and doesn't get to the core root of the problem, which is the rising cost and the fact that incomes have failed to keep pace with the rising cost of tuition. So yes, more needs to be done at the federal and state level to invest in higher education so that we're not continuing to kick the can down the road and put the burden on students and families who later have sometimes difficulty with the debt burden, and it can make it an unequal burden on black and low-income families.
What are some of the factors that are contributing to this increase in cost, because we know, as a college professor, I can tell you it sure isn't salary that is contributing. And with technology being as prevalent as it is, one would think implementing greater technological advancements in the classroom, such as books, would bring down the cost of books. So what are some of the things quickly that are contributing to this rising cost?
Well, it is the cost of operating a university. So it is things like salaries, but also primarily healthcare coverage for staff, energy costs for the schools, as well as really the decrease in state support for universities.
There we go. The decrease in federal support to states and states' right. support to their institutions. Got it. Wow, thank you. Heather Jarvis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on News One Now, rapper, actor, and activist David Banner talks about his lecture series that's selling out and tells you where to find his new music. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Recently, News One Now guest host Laura Coates caught up with rapper, actor, and activist David Banner. They talked about his new album called The God Box and his lecture series of the same name.
The lecture series, honestly, I believe that I'm a man of vision, but I didn't see this lecture series. What happened was is that I had been lecturing at Harvard, Stanford, all of these, you know, Ivy League colleges, and a young lady named Jasmine Kimball from Birmingham, Alabama, called me and said, well, you know, what about us small towns? And then I realized that, you know, I had been doing all these lectures and I hadn't been going to the places that needed them the most. Mm-hmm. And we have literally been selling out. I mean, there's been lines wrapped around the building just to hear me speak. Not even no music, just to hear me speak. So the God Box lecture series has been awesome.
Where does God Box come from? What is that about?
The God Box is sort of like the secret. Mm. It's something that people have to come to on their own. I just say that God is a lot closer than we think. I believe that people look for God in every place, mm-hmm. but where he, she, or it really is. When I work on me, when I eat right, when I fast, when I read the right things, when I'm around the right people in the right environment, I vibrate and the universe brings everything to me that I need. So, like, some people would like to call it magic, but it's really not magic. It's that God in you that people don't understand and don't look for.
Well, you know, you certainly have a unique perspective and you're very relatable to people. And I think it's a message that I think a lot of political candidates wish they could do and have that funnel through you, their messages. But you haven't taken a stance on who you want to be president or what's going on, have you?
Yes, but I will say one thing. the ladies happen to like me. And they think that I'm very attractive, so. There you go. I'm sorry.
Well, women do like a long goatee every night. The salt and pepper does a little something. It's a little disarming, David. A little disarming.
But this is what I say. If I had to pick, it would be Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders people came to me and asked me, you know, to help them. They saw me speak one time, and one of his representatives said he's never seen anybody move a crowd of people like I do. And I told him, I said, I honestly don't trust any of you all. I said, you had a left wing and a right wing, but they're part of the same bird in the same system. I said, Bernie, I told them to tell Bernie, I said, Bernie, if you get on TV, and say what you're going to, literally tell me what you're going to do for people. Because you have to have an agenda. That's the same thing that I feel about President Obama. One of the reasons why nothing has happened for black people, because we don't truly have an agenda. Every other specialized group of people know what they want.
What do you think should be the platform that a candidate needs to use to appeal to the so-called black voter?
Well, it is my personal opinion that if we don't know what we want, it doesn't matter anyway. I think it comes similar to what we're talking about, the God Box, which you can pre-order right now, is that it must come from self first. You know, if you were to ask the average Mexican what he wants, what do you think they would say?
It'd probably be cohesive more than the black community.
But what do you think it would be about?
You have to assume immigration reform.
Exactly. So until we find that one thing, and I tell people, because I'm from the hood, we can roll dice and pick something out of a hat. I don't really care what it is, but it has to come from us. Then we have to make them agree to it, then hold them accountable.
Well, here's something that does come from David Banner, who is so nice to talk to. Before I let you go, tell us about your new music on the God Box. What am I gonna hear? What are we going to love?
How you say that don't affect us? Tuskegee, how you let them infect us? Yeah, it's fear of the black semen, putting sage on a page to eradicate these demons. This for Tulsa, Oklahoma, this for Rosewood. This for Philly when the cops bomb the whole hood. This for Harlem when the pigs stop and frisk. All my folks from the Congo tell Belgium, sucker. Boy, wonder, nope, I'm Mick Dick Grayson. I'm essential like the Moors, what a Mason. The Kush, the black push. Aborigines, I love you. Take back the bush. Oh.
The new music, I would say, is just a conglomerate effort of my life. I think it's one of the best hip-hop albums in a very, very long time. But one of the reasons why I'm doing the God Box Lecture Series is because you can't expect people to purchase a conscious album when they're not conscious. So I believe it's my responsibility to go city to city and to sort of give reason and rationale of what I'm talking about. Because if you think about it, if a person is thinking on a third grade level and you give them an album that's college material, it's sort of hard for them to comprehend. Now, the person in college can feel the kindergarten music or the third grade music because they've been there. So for me, the God Box is just pushing black music and the consciousness and the even the word count of what people expect from my people to another level. Because I remember when I was growing up, I stopped eating pork because of Brand Nubian. You know, Public Enemy taught us to fight the power. So when we have this music, what are we giving our people an opportunity to pull from it? And I think a little bit of the politics, a little bit of what we've been able to go through from the streets, and me actually even making it. In my album, I'm giving explanation, rationale, and reason for that. And I think it's a pathway for people to do better and find a way to consciousness.
When does it drop?
It's supposed to drop May 13th, but I'm pushing it back.
Supposed to come out last year, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was supposed to come back. But this is what come out. But this is what I've been telling people. Until I feel like the people are ready, I'll push it back. I'm not going to Dr. Dre the people. It's going to come out. It's going to come out. But it's probably the way that it's looking now, the end of the summer, it'll definitely be out. But the cool thing about it is every single that I drop, they release it in iTunes or Google Play. Mm-hmm. So as much music as you hear, you'll be able to get it. Like if you pre-order it, there's 4 songs that have been released so far. People have those songs. So.
Well, what about the lecture series? How can people find out more information about how to see David Banner in God Box Lecture Series?
You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter is David Banner. On Facebook, / David Banner. Instagram, that people seem to really like my Instagram. Ladies, I know why. It's David Banner Likes Pictures. And then you can hit me on my website, David Banner, www.davidbanner.com.
Well, the charismatic David Banner, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it. It was nice to meet you. The ladies do like him. It's confirmed.
I'm Wilmer Leon, and this is News One Now. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
It's birthday shout-out time. Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton turns 27. Actor Kobe Bell turns 41. Dancer and actor Adolfo Quiñones, also known as Shabadoo, turns 61. And the Nation of Islam's minister, Louis Farrakhan, turns 83. Happy birthday, my brother. On this day in history, in 1892, 15-year-old Alonzo Lonnie Clayton becomes the youngest rider to win the Kentucky Derby. And in 1968, 9 busloads of people arrive in Washington, D.C. to participate in the Poor People's Campaign. Wow. Tomorrow on News One Now, Roland will take a look at HIV, at the HIV epidemic in Atlanta. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon. Thank you for watching. Have a great day.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.